This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. On Tuesday, a law enforcement task force raided a pharmacy in Orlando, Florida, as part of what appears to be an enormous ring that was selling steroids, human growth hormone, and various other performance-enhancing substances over the internet. More than two dozen doctors, pharmacists, and business owners have been implicated. Joining me now to discuss the investigation underway is Brendan Lyons, a senior writer for the Albany Times-Union. Brendan, thank you for joining me.
No problem.
Can you take us through what happened this week?
Well, this week, the task force that was based in Orlando had finally gotten everything it needed, apparently, to make a series of raids across the state of Florida. The primary target in this case all along had been this Orlando pharmacy, Signature Pharmacy. Shortly after 9:30 on Tuesday morning, a task force that consisted of Treasury agents, DEA agents, health department investigators, a smattering of, you know, state police officers, hit this place and went inside, and they ultimately arrested the four people who run the operation. And they interviewed, they spent most of Tuesday interviewing many of the workers, I think, in an attempt to solicit their cooperation with the prosecution as it moves forward.
Most of the pharmacies under investigation are in Florida and Alabama. Why are charges being filed in New York?
One of the reasons is that New York has some of the strictest prescription medication laws in the country. The other thing that's been lost in all this is that federal laws or the federal sentencing guidelines are out of line with, you know, the crimes that are taking place. In other words, even if you sold about 40,000 tablets of testosterone under federal laws, you'd be subject to less than 6 months in jail if convicted. And so what the federal authorities have said is that until Congress makes it, you know, a much more severe penalty, we need state prosecutors to step up and start taking on some of these cases because the state laws and the state penalties are much more severe.
Before this story broke, how easy was it for somebody to buy steroids and human growth hormone online? And is it still possible for people to do that?
It is. And it's, you know, the one thing that shouldn't be overlooked here is that this is one of many pharmacies across the nation that specializes in testosterone, human growth hormone prescriptions. You know, as we've been looking at this now for months, and I've even read, you know, the Hartford Courant did a series, I think a couple of years ago, and the Washington Post did its own series in 2003. And those newspapers both exposed then how easy it was for someone to go online, and it could be a teenager posing as an adult, and make up some sort of medical condition. They're evaluated by a doctor online or sometimes not at all. Mm-hmm. And you can use a fake name, and as long as you have access to money and can somehow get them a blood test, you know, the sky's the limit, it seems, for what you can order online.
Well, given the potential for abuse and the obvious abuse in cases like this, how have these websites been able to operate in such an open way without state or federal authorities coming down on them?
I think it's been a matter of there's so many of them. And, you know, in one of our stories, we pointed out that in 2003, there was testimony before the House Committee on Reform. And at that time, they were warned that they don't have the resources to crack down on these pharmacies, and they were like a wildfire across the nation. I mean, they were setting them up almost as fast as they could. And they just, it always comes down to a matter of resources, I think. There has been a lot of takedowns, though, of these types of pharmacies, especially by the DEA and the FDA. A lot of times they'll get very little publicity, in some cases none at all. And I think that when you have a case like this where you get high-profile names, that's when the nation tends to pay attention. But it's when it's just a three-person operation out of L.A. or Tampa or someplace, I think that people tend to, you know, not take it seriously.
Unlike the Balco case, which dealt mostly, it seems, with high-profile athletes, professional athletes, the people most affected by these raids seem to be college and high school athletes and guys who just work in gyms. Is that correct?
They indicated that the most common client here is, you know, a middle-aged man, someone in their 40s or 50s, who, you know, and they called it the triad or something, where they get, you know, testosterone-type products for their muscles, they get some sort of product for hair, you know, regrowth, and then some sort of product like Viagra or something for, you know, sex drive, and, you know, the middle-aged crisis package. And because the one thing, you know, although high school students and college students certainly do abuse these drugs, I think about 3% of high school seniors are now said to try or use steroids. It's very expensive to do it through pharmaceutical companies. And you're talking, in some cases, $1,000 to $1,500 every 6 weeks to stay, to keep an active cycle of these drugs.
Some of these pharmacies did allegedly have pro athletes as customers. Gary Matthews Jr. of the Los Angeles Angels has been mentioned, as has former heavyweight boxing champion Evander Holyfield. Do the authorities plan on taking any action against those two and others, or does this investigation remain focused on the suppliers?
This remains, in New York State, the state prosecution remains focused on the suppliers, I believe. Now, the names you just mentioned, those people are allegedly customers or had been of Applied Pharmacy in Mobile, Alabama. That pharmacy, the two principals, I think, have or will be indicted in Albany County for charges related to this case. But I think there is a much more in-depth federal investigation of that facility ongoing. And it was that federal investigation that uncovered those names. It was not state prosecutors in New York.
Do you anticipate that there will be more pro athletes in various sports involved in this?
That's what they tell us they expect. And one of the things that's an unknown to them that they were going to glean, they hoped, from the records of Signature Pharmacy was a client list. And that was going to be, you know, they seized their hard drives from their computers and their written records that they could get their hands on. And then from there, they can begin backtracking, you know, interview people who are customers and clients. And so I think from the end users, they're looking more for cooperation and perhaps even testimony down the road. They can be prosecuted, but it's rarely done because they're in a defensible position in some ways, in that if they're given a prescription, even if it's an illicit one, it's hard to prove sometimes, I think. And not only that, you're talking about potentially thousands of people. And in the end, I think what the federal and state government have said is we need to stop the distribution, not punish end users.
Brendan Lyons is a senior writer for the Albany Times-Union. Brendan, thank you very much.
You bet, Bill.
NCAA basketball conference tournaments have begun as hoop squads from all over the country vie for prestige and, in some cases, automatic berths in March's huge hoedown. The women of Duke University will also be fighting to keep that team's 30-0 record unsullied. Joining me now on the line from Greensboro, North Carolina, is Jack Daly, who covers the Blue Devils for the Durham Herald Sun. Jack, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me.
Duke defeated Virginia yesterday to advance to the ACC semifinals. They'll play North Carolina State today. Is there any reason to believe Duke won't capture its first ACC title since 2004?
Well, NC State has been playing well lately. They beat North Carolina, so certainly a game against them wouldn't be a picnic. It's certainly not a formality that they'll advance to Sunday's championship game.
Tell me about some of the Duke players we should keep an eye on as the tournament rolls along.
Harding would be the first and foremost on that list. She's been at her best in their big games, so she's the first one to look at. She's probably the best point guard in the country. She was voted the ACC Player of the Year, and she has a good chance of being the National Player of the Year. Beyond that, Allison Bales is a presence down low. She's 6'7", so she blocks a lot of shots. And then there's Abby Wehner. If you saw the game at Tennessee, she was 5 of 5 for three-pointers in the first half, so she can get hot and provide some scoring punch.
You can make an argument that it's a great thing to carry an undefeated record into the postseason, or you can make an argument that a team might be better off if it had lost somewhere during the season, because maybe then it would learn that it could happen. What do you think vis-a-vis Duke this time around?
Well, Gail's saying that she doesn't need a loss to as a learning experience. We'll see if she changes her tune if they actually do lose, because a lot of people think you lose a game, you learn, you grow, and that's why it's a benefit. This Duke team thinks that they've learned from their wins, so they don't need to go through that experience of losing a game and that self-analysis because they're doing it anyway.
It's not exactly a surprise that the Duke women's basketball team is a good team. They were runners-up in the national tournament in 1999. They did that again last year, 2006, but they've never won the NCAA championship. Is this the year?
Good question. It's not a surprise they're good. I think it's a bit of a surprise they're this good. They lost Monique Curry, Misty Williams, Jess Foley off of last year's team, and then they haven't had the services of Shantae Black all season, who was supposed to start. So I don't know what Gail Gestenkor certainly didn't think at the beginning of the year they'd be this good. I don't think it's a slam dunk that they win this year. I mean, there's other Tennessee's playing well. They can beat them. Connecticut can beat them. There's certainly other teams that, even though Duke is undefeated, that they're not unbeatable.
This team has the advantage, of course, of playing in basketball country. People really care about basketball down there in North Carolina, especially when Duke is playing UNC. Has the women's team generated the same kind of excitement in this run that the men's team generally does?
It's getting there. Last week, Duke had, and this one's tough to pronounce, it's Gestenkorsopoulos, I think is how you'd, it's one of those that's easier to type out than to pronounce. They had a little bit of a tent city to rival Krzyzewskiville over there on the Duke campus. I mean, it's certainly, the general interest doesn't compare with the men's program, but it's improving. Both the Carolina Duke women's games were sold out. Duke's had a couple sellouts this year. Carolina's had a couple sellouts. So, I mean, it's getting there. It'd be interesting to see what would happen if they won the national championship, if that would kind of push it to the next level or not.
Jack Daly covers the Blue Devils for the Durham Herald Sun, and he joined me on the line from Greensboro, North Carolina. Jack, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Well, thanks.
It's 19 minutes. I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, nurturing the neurons of novice netsters. But first, as the Pittsburgh Penguins worked out on Tuesday morning at Mellon Arena, it may have occurred to some of them that if the 2006-2007 season were to end this weekend, they would make the Stanley Cup playoffs, something the Penguins have not done since 2001. It may also have occurred to some of them that if the 2007-2008 season were to begin this weekend, the Penguins would be playing it in Pittsburgh. But because said season won't begin until next fall, and because the Penguins' lease on Mellon Arena expires at the end of June, migration is a possibility. At various times over the past year, Tulsa, Kansas City, and several cities in Canada have offered to welcome the Penguins, though Pittsburgh Mayor Luke Ravenstahl doesn't like their chances.
We're still in discussions with the Penguins, and I am optimistic and confident that the arena proposal that we have currently under negotiations with the Penguins is competitive with all those other cities that were just mentioned. We have a strong fan base here, a great team, a young team, and I'm confident that we'll continue to negotiate and ideally reach a deal in the very near future.
The deal, by which Mayor Ravenstahl hopes to assure the presence of the Penguins, involves the introduction of casino gambling to his city. Part of the profits of the group that won the Pennsylvania license to operate slot machines in Pittsburgh would be earmarked for the construction of a new home for the Penguins. This, says the mayor, is what distinguishes Pittsburgh from all the cities that have been fleeced by teams threatening to move if they don't get new buildings and new deals.
Pittsburgh is in a unique situation because of the Pennsylvania gaming law that was passed that allows us, at the beginning of these negotiations, to have $230 million from gaming revenue. So therefore, the tax revenue that would be necessary to fund the remainder of the arena wouldn't be as great as probably in some other cities because of this unique circumstance, which we can use gaming money.
The Pittsburghers, who financed the proposed new building by dumping their discretionary income into slot machines, will experience the same dismay they would have had they been taxed by more traditional means. No matter, Mayor Ravenstahl, who at 27 is younger than several of the Penguins, has at least two compelling reasons for positive thinking regarding the team's future in his city. The first is that losing the Penguins would mean a deflating of his constituency.
There would be, and the city, you know, believes in their sports teams. They identify with the Steelers, they identify with the Pirates, and certainly they identify with the Penguins. And from a morale standpoint, to lose a team like the Penguins would certainly be very difficult for this region. That being said, it would also be a significant financial loss, both for us as a government, as we rely on many tax revenues from the team and the use of that facility, as well as the surrounding businesses that have a vested interest in having the crowds at the arena on a nightly basis.
For the record, crowds the Penguins have not lacked. The tired and exquisitely unattractive arena fans have nicknamed the Mound seats fewer than 17,000, but this season it has often been full. The Penguins have averaged more than 16,000 fans per game. Some of the fans even show up at Mellon Arena for practices, which was the case on Tuesday morning. They wait at the edge of the players' parking lot, hoping some of their heroes will idle their SUVs long enough to sign posters or hockey pucks. One of those engaged in that ritual this week was Nick Davidson, who said the rumors that the Penguins might move had never caused him any concern.
Never got worried, and if they moved, we already had a place to do a job somewhere else wherever they moved. Already had apartments ready to go.
You're going with them?
Yes, we are.
Okay.
Better to be with them than in Pittsburgh, because Pittsburgh's not worth living here without Penguins.
So, perhaps Mayor Ravenstahl's concerns are not unfounded. But in this area that's become somewhat notorious for losing its youth to regions where there is more work and more to do after work, not to mention better weather, have the Penguins really helped to stem the tide? I asked Penguin fan Mark DeZara, a Duquesne University student, whether attending college in Pittsburgh would be as much fun if the Penguins weren't there.
Oh, definitely not. I mean, when there's nothing to do on a weekday night, come down to see the Pens. It's awesome. I mean, the student rush line's pretty full. There's always students from Duquesne and Pitt and Robert Morris. It's a good promotion.
All right, so the city government wants to keep the team, and the fans in the parking lot want the Penguins to stay home. What about the players? In the Pittsburgh locker room after practice, I asked some of them.
Personally, I love it here. So this is a great sports town, and I wouldn't want the team to leave.
Well, sure, but that was Ryan Malone. He's the only guy on the team who was born in Pittsburgh. His dad was a Penguin scout. What else would he say? But so many of his teammates seemed equally enthusiastic about staying that I finally took up the matter directly with center Eric Christensen.
Now, has anybody told you guys, hey, if anybody asks, you got to say you love it here in Pittsburgh, or is that really the way you feel?
I mean, especially this past couple years, our fans have just been crazy every game. You know, that student rush thing has really been successful, and we love playing at home. It's a huge thrill, big atmosphere. It's, you know, it's kind of like playing in Montreal type play. You know, that's the atmosphere. There's a buzz in the air. I think the city just loves the team, the youth and the exuberance of the team. So, and we're getting better every day. So the fans deserve it. They deserve a new arena, but they also deserve more that the team stays here.
Players might be expected to praise the team's fans, just as they might be expected to express enthusiasm for the city, at least as long as the microphone is on. But Dave Molinari, the Penguins beat writer for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, agrees with Eric Christensen's appraisal of the team's supporters.
Certainly in the United States, this is one of the better hockey markets. I have to say that a gentleman who's willing to relocate if the franchise does is more the exception than the rule. But this team does have a pretty devoted following, and particularly among young people, which is a demographic that Western Pennsylvania has been hemorrhaging for three decades or so. And so if even two people would follow the team to Kansas City or wherever, it would be a significant loss. We don't have kids to spare anymore.
Then there's the matter of whether those who will patronize the casino that would partially finance the new building the Penguins require can spare the money. But asking that question may be premature, since those who would build the new arena and those who would help finance it have not yet agreed on terms. Which is why Dave Molinari is less optimistic than Mayor Ravenstahl is about where the Penguins will next play.
At this point, I think there is reason for people in Pittsburgh to be cautiously optimistic, but I think it's safe to say that in any high-stakes negotiations like the ones that are going on now, They could be sabotaged by any number of things. If there is something that the Penguins decide they absolutely have to have in terms of a lease or a financing arrangement for a new arena, and the politicians they're negotiating with decide that's simply something they can't give, then the whole deal falls apart, and it doesn't matter how much progress had been made to that point. So I think anyone who assumes that this is a foregone conclusion, that the Penguins will stay in Pittsburgh, is perhaps not assessing the situation objectively.
A lack of objectivity may not be entirely unprecedented when it comes to matters of the heart, like whether the home team will leave town or even how well the team will finish the season. Mayor Ravenstahl's attitude remains positive.
Fortunately for us, the Penguins are doing better now, and it looks like they'll probably make the playoffs. So it's good news all the way around. And then once we ideally reach this arena deal, it'll be happy days in Pittsburgh for Penguin fans.
The mayor is anxious for those happy days to commence before the Penguins' lease with the Mellon Center expires in less than 4 months, a development which would no doubt delight the NHL schedule makers, who would like to know sooner rather than later where teams will have to go to play the Penguins next season. Everybody knows that great athletes achieve their greatness through practice, just as everybody knows that superior genes explain the performances of those athletes. Recent research suggests that it's not as simple as that. I'm joined now by Daniel Coyle, whose article titled How to Grow a Super Athlete will appear in Play magazine in this Sunday's New York Times. He's in the studio at KBBI in Homer, Alaska. Daniel, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
You did some serious traveling for this story. What is the difference between practice, as we're likely to understand the term here in the U.S., and the sort of practice that goes on at tennis clubs in Russia and driving ranges in South Korea?
Well, this story started with kind of a mystery, wondering what is called, I guess, technically a big stupid question. Where does real talent come from? And to look at that, we drew a map and looked at the top 100 people in various sports. And the map was distributed very interestingly. You had these clusters of people. And most people have a sense that there are a lot of good Dominican baseball players, players in the major leagues who were born in the Dominican Republic. It's the same sort of clustering that happens in tennis. You have a lot of players from Moscow. In women's golf, you have a lot of players from South Korea. And so the notion of the story was to, let's look at this map and let's go to some of these hot spots, because what's happening there is clearly different than what's happening in the U.S. and other places. And to see what's different, it really did come down to that practice process.
Did you find a lot of differences between the way especially young athletes train country to country?
Well, I did. There was the old saying that perfect practice makes perfect. And that is something that clearly is happening in all of those places. But I was surprised. I went to a tennis club called Spartak outside of Moscow. That club consists of one indoor court. In Moscow, it tends to snow a little bit, and so they do have some outdoor courts, but mostly they're on this one indoor court. From that one indoor court, they've produced more top 20 tennis players than the entire United States in the last 3 years. I expected it to be kind of a factory setting. We all have that conception of the Soviet Union, that they're churning these kids out, they're little robots. And what I found was a very loving, somewhat casual environment presided over by a 77-year-old woman, Larissa Preobrazhenska, who is the coach. And by the way, the coach at Spartak sort of struck me as a combination of Bear Bryant, the football coach, and sort of a loving grandma. The emotion that was in these places, the warmth that was in these places was striking to me. They weren't factories. They were more like gardens. There was a lot of love. There was a lot of attention. There was a lot of excitement in the kids. One of the girls at Spartak woke up in the morning and she said to her parents, "Today is my day. I get to go to Spartak." And that kind of enthusiasm is what literally, and what some neuroscientists are telling us now, grows talent.
Let's look at one particular training technique that you discovered at Spartak. What is the advantage in pretending to hit an imaginary tennis ball rather than whacking a real ball off a real backboard?
Yeah, it comes down to, you can get several answers from this. The coaches tell you that because you take the ball out of the equation, you can work on the right muscle groups, you can practice it, you can perfect it. And that seems fairly straightforward and intuitive. What's interesting is that when you ask neuroscientists the same question, they're telling us a little bit about a substance called myelin, which grows in your brain and which grows along circuits that fire. And if you practice a certain circuit, what you're actually doing is building up this thing called myelin, which is, in this sense, skill. It is practice. And you're creating these circuits that you can then replicate, and produce under pressure. So they're doing these things in Spartak to build these complex circuits. Competing at a game or hitting a ball is can be fairly random. But to do the same thing over and over and to really groove it and to build that myelin along the proper circuit, you're doing what Tiger Woods is doing.
The myelin argument seems to me to suggest that acquiring a talent and honing a talent is essentially a mechanical process. So is that correct?
Well, not quite. It has a mechanical element, certainly. But what you see in Spartak, what you see in these places, myelin is really, when you get down to it, it's kind of formed through love and through passion. If you are burning to do it, if you identify with it, if you feel like it may be your escape from a difficult situation, if your parents reinforce it. I go back to thinking of it as a garden. When you have all of these factors, the soil, the water, the air, the sunlight, and they all go into growing that beautiful plant, that orchid. Really, at the core of it is that kind of irrational love. You know, why did Jimmy Connors hit so many balls as a kid? You know, why did Tiger Woods get into it? You have parents encouraging them, and you have that passion. Mm-hmm. And that, in a sense, is what it's made of.
Some of the things in your article are not going to surprise people. You fall back on the recognition that good genes, good training, good motivation are all essential to the development of a great athlete. But does the research, the newer research that you've examined, suggest the order of importance of those factors?
I think it does, and I think it's a lot more. I think right now we tend to think of talent, as parents, as coaches, as sort of a magical substance that's out there. And we hope to find somebody with it, and we know it when we see it. But this research, this myelin, is really being seen as a bit of an epiphany in the neurological world and also in the athletic world, because you've got to hear a mechanism that is behind all talent that is grown. And we're not just talking about sports here. We're talking about learning how to play the piano. We're talking about learning how to speak another language, learning how to play the violin, learning how to be a good radio host, for example. These are circuits that we fire over and over again, and as we slowly build up the myelin is an insulation on the circuit. It allows the circuit to fire more accurately and much faster. So that being such a basic process and fueled by passion, fueled by repetition, I think makes it a lot more democratic than we think of. We think of, well, if you were born to be Tiger Woods, that's all and good, but This research seems to indicate that this power, this myelination, really is accessible to all of us, and it has a lot of profound implications for the way we approach education, the way we approach coaching our children, and that basic mechanism is what really I think will reorder our sense of the priorities of these things.
Daniel, since you began the article with a discussion of a very personal experience, your own daughter's attempt to hit a big purple ball with some sort of wiffle ball bat or something, I can't resist asking if she is building up the necessary myelin to get the hang of it.
She's doing quite well, and it's mostly due to her, not to me. It is funny, though, Bill, because doing this story and learning about where talent comes from, the true root of it, does change the way you look at the world, and it's changed the way I look at my kids. Before I did this story, there was sort of this element of mystery and magic, and that's still there, but it's not quite as important when you have this picture of what's happening inside them. When you think about these things, well, it's not about them. It's about how much they work at it. It's about how much they're passionate about it. It's about how many hours they put into it because they love it. So it sort of values effort and passion over sort of this mysterious, magical Christmas gift sense of talent.
The flip side of the practice theory is, of course, that you look at your own child and you say, hey, if you're not getting really good at this, it's because you're not trying hard enough. There is a certain amount of natural talent that has to be involved for the Tiger Woods and Michael Jordans of the world, no?
Yeah, everybody has got their proclivities and everybody's got their attitudes. And It's interesting, though, when you put kind of passion and love at the center of it, at the center of myelination, at the center of these things that lets us build these circuits, you don't really want to push a kid into something they naturally don't want to do. What you do want to create is a kid who can be enthusiastic about everything.
Daniel Coyle wrote the article titled How to Grow a Super Athlete that will appear in Play Magazine in tomorrow's New York Times. He joined me from the studios of KBBI in Homer, Alaska. Daniel, thank you very much for speaking with me.
You're welcome.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, and from other NPR stations that air this program. Indigene Pharmaceuticals, maker of Relaxane, a supplement for relieving the symptoms of everyday stress, available at Rite Aid GNC stores and Relaxane.com. And Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, sailing over the bounding main without messing up the world. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
This week, authorities raided offices of internet pharmacies, arousing speculation that many pro athletes may have received steroids and other performance enhancers. But the investigation looks as if it will have an even greater impact on the supply chain for high school and college athletes, not to mention meatheads at your local gym. Does that make it different from other doping investigations about which we've spoken?
Well, it makes it more vast, obviously, and I think that there's no question that the more internet literate among us, which generally you get more internet literate the younger you are going to find themselves tangled up in this, because this was obviously the easiest way to do this with little or no trail except a cyber trail and whatever receipts they may have seized in the raid. My only problem, again, with this particular investigation and this particular law enforcement episode is that it's already leaking like a sieve, and people's names are coming out.
Former Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell is supposed to be conducting an investigation into the use of steroids by Major League Baseball players. So far, most of the players with whom he wishes to speak have said no. Thank you very much. Does he have any authority to move discussions beyond that point?
No, actually. He took the job and told me, at least in an interview, that his basic mandate was to move forward, not to go back to the era we're talking about, but to develop a policy going forward that Major League Baseball can have to deal with what it perceives to be a problem within the game, and apparently not even willing to cooperate to that point. He may very well produce some proposals that move us forward, but he's certainly not going to get to the bottom of what happened in the last 20 years.
Charlie, it's conference tournament time.
You bet.
Have you been
the
swept
Camels
up?
Won.
Have you been swept up in pre-madness?
Actually, no. I've been swept up in the regular season because there have been some terrific games this week. Florida got beat. North Carolina got beat. Memphis almost got beat. There's been some terrific television games. But the conference tournaments are moving along for those people already filling out brackets. And you know who you are, you lifeless souls. VMI, the Virginia Military Institute, is already causing problems for teams on what the kids like to call the bubble. They're the sixth seed. They're in the Big South Conference final tournament against Winthrop, the consensus number one seed, and a really good ball club. If VMI were somehow to get past Winthrop, then the Big South would have to be considered to have two bids, which means some large conference, power conference rat hole is going to have a very nervous couple of weeks.
Okay, Charlie, it's time to play Name That Tune, and in this case, Name That Singer.
Wish that I was on a rocky top down in the Tennessee hills. Ain't no smoggy smoke on rocky top, ain't no telephone bills.
No, that sounds like rocky Patsy Decline. No, actually, that's Tennessee basketball coach Pat Summitt singing Rocky Top as kind of a thank you for Tennessee men's basketball coach Bruce Pearl coming to one of her games with his upper body painted orange. I think Pat's found a much more dignified way to say thank you, and I think a grateful nation rejoices.
And she was a cheerleader in the 7th and 8th grade, so this was probably great fun to return to.
She
that
had to
August
be. I got to say, she had to be the toughest cheerleader who ever lived.
The man who had been identified as the NFL's top concussion expert has resigned. Charlie, was this in part because Dr. Elliot Pelman didn't turn out to be such a concussion expert after all?
This was all about the fact that the concussion expert didn't know anything about, concussions. ESPN, the magazine, looked into this guy's background. Some experts who actually knew something about concussions looked into it and said that let's get serious about this and let's find somebody who knows what they're talking about.
Women's pro soccer is scheduled to return in 13 months. So says Tanya Antonucci of the Women's Soccer Initiative. Do you think the new league, if it does in fact launch in 13 months, can succeed where the WUSA failed?
I don't have any idea. It's supposed to capitalize on interest generated in the 2007 Women's World Cup to be held in China.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, let's see. What happens if the United States of America, God forbid, stumbles to a third-place finish? It's been known to happen in international competition. What happens to your league then? I don't know. I wish them well, as we always do. I am not optimistic.
Former Edmonton Oiler Ryan Smith is now a New York Islander, Charlie. On Wednesday, he wept as he told reporters that should his new team win the Stanley Cup, he would bring it back to Edmonton to share it with fans there. Their desire to see the Cup land in Uniondale, notwithstanding, his new employers couldn't have been entirely thrilled, I wouldn't think.
Probably not, but you know what? I've been saying this for a while. I like Edmonton. It's a great town. It cannot support, for any length of time, a good professional sports franchise. It has to deal off every good player it has before they become a free agent, because the revenue base in Edmonton just isn't there. There should not be professional sports teams in places like Edmonton, just as there should not be high-level professional sports teams in places like Fargo.
During the 2007-2008 NHL season, the Anaheim Ducks will play the Los Angeles Kings in London, and not London, Ontario. London, England. How do you suppose they'll be received?
Well, I think people skating around, hitting each other with sticks, it's right down the British sports demographic, isn't it? What I like, though, is the quote from the Anaheim Ducks general manager, Brian Burke, about why these particular Aravist franchises are being sent over to represent the NHL. Showcasing a great rivalry between two Cubs from the Southern California market will be terrific for the NHL. That sound you're hearing? That's Toe Blake spinning in his grave somewhere outside Montreal.
Speaking of London, as we were, the IOC is concerned that it will cost almost $20 billion to put the 2012 games there. That's triple the original estimate. What's going on? Are world wheat markets driving the price of crumpets into the stratosphere?
It's the Olympics. Cost overruns? Who would have guessed?
I'm shocked.
Phony bids? Hidden costs? The Olympics? It's hard to imagine.
This week, Boston Red Sox pitcher Julian Tavares asked a Boston Herald reporter, "Would you like Jennifer Lopez to give you a kiss?" What was this rhetorical question in reference to?
Well, his friend Manny Ramirez wants the option years picked up on his contract by the Red Sox. Manny is in camp. He's near as I'm going to tell. He's in shape, which cannot be said for, among other people, Curt Schilling. And he appears ready to go for a big year. The question is, will the Red Sox maintain this kind of fractious relationship they've had with their star? I really hope they do. I really hope he retires in a Boston uniform, because for all the obvious problems, I think Manny Ramirez is a hoot.
This week, a White House spokesman declined to comment on a particular 2007 baseball card. Why would anybody want the White House to comment on a baseball card?
Oh, the Photoshop era is upon us. There's a Topps Derek Jeter card that has not only got George Bush waving from the stands behind the dugout behind Derek Jeter, but has Mickey Mantle in the dugout.
Splendid.
Why he's in the dugout and not in the on-deck circle to bat behind Jeter is anybody's guess, by the way.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. He joins me each week at this time for Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thank you, Bill.
Oh, I love Mickey.
Mickey who?
Mickey Mantle. Ooh, I love you.
Who, me?
Ooh, I love you.
Not Yogi Berra.
Ooh, I love you.
In Palm Beach Gardens, Florida, the PGA did light, and with it was John Daly. I'm not sure if he was tight, but in the fray that followed, Daly's day did not go well, and so his tragic story I will now attempt to tell. John Daly stood upon the tee, and he addressed the ball, and then to the astonishment of one, and also all, as he began his backswing with his mighty golfing stick, there rang across the tee the quite forbidden sound of click And oh, the gallery sighed as one, as Daly stopped his swing, and glared then at the woman who had dared the wretch to bring her camera to the golf course, though the PGA has said that people must not do that and should leave it home instead. John Daly stepped up once again, and once more he began to try to hit the ball, but pain immediately ran across his back, and so he stopped and left the field of play. No more would he be seen about the golf course on that day. For as he stopped his driver partway through the club's descent, some portion of his back complained. It might have even bent. Now Daly has a mighty swing. He's not without resources. His drives have made a joke of holes on lots of golf's best courses, and he has been a favorite of the fans from here to there, in part for living at a pace that none of them could bear. He has acknowledged, Daly has, his multiple addictions to cigarettes and alcohol, as well as predilections for marriage and divorce. He's been through each four times, it seems. He's found the perfect marriage partner only in his dreams. Beyond that, he's a gambler and a glutton dedicated to stuffing his great belly even after he is sated. He's also known to wander off the course before he's done, which, for the people in his wake, has not been any fun. But Daly, for his mighty drives and his determined grin, has not, in recent memory, been often known to win. In fact, he'd made just two cuts in his five events this season, so even if the camera hadn't clicked, there is no reason to think he would have won the Honda Classic anyway. In fact, for 9 long years, it wasn't ever Daly's day, for in that span that ended only in 2004, he never won a tournament. He would have been a bore if he had not amused the crowds with his buffoonish ploys, the sort of mad excess each voyeuristic slob enjoys, the drinking and the gambling and the bombast and hot air. So whether Daly made the cut, they really didn't care. I wonder, did the woman with the camera in Palm Beach do Daly a disservice? Would it really be a reach to say she gave him reason to depart the course that day, to do one of the many things he'd rather do than play? On Tuesday in Barbados, Earth Race, a state-of-the-art biodiesel-powered boat, will attempt to set a new world record for global circumnavigation, though the craft will, in a sense, be competing against the vessel that holds the current record of just under 75 days. Its crew says the point is to raise public awareness of renewable fuels. Earth Race toured the Eastern Seaboard last year, and Only a Game's Monica Brady-Meyeroff went aboard for a visit.
It's dark on Boston Harbor when I arrive to see the boat. I'm concerned I won't find it among the bobbing sailboats and yachts. But you couldn't miss the Earth Race. It appears to hover on the surface like a silver water bug. Lights illuminate the underside of what look like wings on either side of the long, wave-piercing hull. It's specially designed to perform at high speeds in the world's toughest ocean conditions. At the wheel of this trimaran, you might expect to find an experienced boater, but what you find is a crazy Kiwi.
For sure, we're not racers. I've never raced a single powerboat in my life. And it's funny, I'm not a boatie.
That's the skipper of the boat, Pete Bethune.
I'm not a mad powerboater, but I firmly believe in biodiesel, and I believe it's got an important role to play in the energy, transport energy mix for countries like the States.
Bethune says he chose sports to highlight biodiesel because races are fun, and he says he's not a tree-hugging environmentalist. In fact, he used to be an oil exploration engineer. But as he watched the world's fossil fuels diminish, he became determined to promote biodiesel. He and his wife sold everything they owned, pieced together sponsorships, donations, and loans to build the $3 million Earth Race that runs on biodiesel, which produces low emissions and is biodegradable. And as a way to draw attention to this unique race, Bethune underwent liposuction in order to use some of his own fat as fuel.
Just a stunt. It helps highlight one of the cool things with biodiesel is you can make it from so many sources. There's over 350 different crops. You can make it from animal fats, from seaweed, from algae. There's so many different sources, and you can also make it from human fats.
But Bethune is a fit guy, and his small vial of fat could only power the boat for about 30 feet. It has to go another 145 million feet to make history. That's 24,000 nautical miles. The current record for circumnavigating the globe, 74 days, 23 hours, was set in 1998 by a British boat named Cable and Wireless. The Earth Race is the first powerboat to attempt to break the record using only sustainable fuel. Captain Bethune.
If you look at past record attempts on this, most of them don't actually finish. It's about nursing this boat round in one piece.
Bethune says the last attempt to break the record was in 2002, when the Spirit of Cardiff, a rigid inflatable boat, nearly sank from a crack in the hull. The sleek Earth Race makes the Spirit of Cardiff look like a tugboat. But former crew member Torsten Sandmark, who's driving the boat around Boston Harbor, says it's also facing the same perils in the sea.
Well, what makes you think you can break the record?
We won't lose because we're not fast enough. If we hit something, because it is a fragile boat, if we hit something in the sea, for instance, a log or a container, because there's a lot of containers and rubbish floating around the sea, that's probably what would end us, but hopefully not.
Circumnavigating the globe represents the pinnacle of powerboat challenges. It's the world's longest race, and the voyage is physically grueling. The crew has to wear weighted belts below the ribcage because the constant bashing from waves bruises the internal organs. And temperatures in the boat will average about 105 degrees because the race is primarily around the equator. There is no air conditioning because it's too heavy and eats up too much fuel. And by the way, says Pete Bethune, there is no bathing for the entire race.
Not many people are mad enough to go attempting such a record. 24,000 nautical miles, it's a long, long way. It's not a holiday camp. It's a brutal, brutal challenge. And most people aren't nuts enough to do it.
Then why are you nuts enough to do it?
I'm doing it because I believe in biodiesel, and I think we can make a very positive contribution with what we're doing.
Devin Yada, a ground crew member, says if they break the record, they hope it will increase interest in biodiesel.
Hopefully it'll start more production. Just from last year alone, America has produced 50% more than they did last year. Maybe engine companies will be more amped to support it. Right now they're a little bit hesitant because they don't want it to come back that biodiesel messes up engines, where we've been running for so long and it hasn't had any repercussions.
But ironically, the one major problem standing between the Earth Race and the world record at this point is fuel. The company that had promised to give them free biofuel for the race pulled out. They're desperately trying to raise $200,000 to buy the fuel needed to complete the trip. Right now, they have enough to get from Barbados to Maui, almost halfway.
And it's the coolest boat in the world. And I might be a little bit biased on that, but I've yet to have someone come up and tell me what is a cooler boat. Looks good.
For Only a Game, I'm Monica Brady-Meyerov in Boston.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Mike Nason at KBBI in Homer, Alaska. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to view my Pittsburgh Penguins photo gallery, listen to stories past and present, or sign up for our newsletter, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Daniel Coyle, who informs me that humans always retain a minimum of 5% of available myelin-forming cells, which results in many benefits.
So if you want to learn Korean or improve your volley or even your radio hosting, which, of course, could not possibly be improved, you can still do it.
What? I'm back on? Oh, ha, 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 Mr. Coyle, I sure can feel those cells improving my radio toasting. Hosted. As I prepare to look for a new line of work. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from WBUR Boston. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in children, their families, and their communities. On the web at WKKF.org. Ann and John Herman, celebrating the Breakthrough Collaborative, involving middle school students in learning and older students in teaching at BreakthroughCollaborative.org. and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, exploring how technology is changing kids and learning at digitallearning.macfound.com.